60, sunny, beautiful day. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. Have a great rest of your day.
I am too terrified to think about the long-term costs of this lack of empathy, because they affect your soul.
Among the costs of 2 years of war in Gaza, a national mental health crisis in Israel.
It's Tuesday, October 7th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Ahead this hour, abortion is legal in Wisconsin.
So why has Planned Parenthood stopped performing the procedure in that state?
We are committed to continuing to find a pathway forward to abortion care in every state where it's legal.
Also, the government shutdown is snarling air travel.
Air traffic controllers are in short supply at airports from New York to Los Angeles.
Plus a new memoir from one of the stars of The Secret Lives of Mormon Wives.
I feel like people watch our show and be like, wow, I can be Mormon and I can swear. I can be Mormon and wear tank tops.
Macy Neal. Neely's new book, Told You So, after these news headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. Chicagoans are bracing for the deployment of National Guard troops. Illinois Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker says troops from Illinois and Texas's National Guard have already arrived and will begin operations in the city later this week. He says Trump is using troops as political pawns and is calling on citizens to document their activities.
What we can't do is just sit idly by while these things are occurring, and that's why we've called on people to take action, like creating evidence for our court cases by pulling out their iPhones and their Android phones and filming everything.
President Trump characterizes Chicago as a war zone and has said he would be willing to invoke the Insurrection Act. That allows a president to dispatch the military in states that are unable to put down an insurrection or are defying federal law. Illinois sued to block Trump's move. A judge gave the administration 2 days to respond to it. A new White House memo is raising questions about whether furloughed federal workers will receive back pay after the government shutdown ends. From member station WAMU, Jenny Abamu reports.
The White House is making the case that hundreds of thousands of furloughed federal workers are not automatically guaranteed back pay. The memo seeks to reinterpret a 2019 law passed during Trump's first term to protect furloughed workers, like Sarah Cobran at the National Institutes of Health. She still wants Democrats to hold the line.
Am I afraid of that consequence? Yeah, of course. I have, you know, dependents and a house and a mortgage and all those things, but I can't invest in every threat, or I wouldn't survive it.
Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen helped write the 2019 back pay law. He says the statute is clear and, quote, there's nothing the administration can do to change that. For NPR News, I'm Jenny Abamu.
ChatGPT maker OpenAI has spent $1 trillion this year on energy to power its AI systems. As NPR's Bobby Allen reports, analysts are warning the AI industry's rapid spending could lead to an investment bubble.
OpenAI has inked about $1 trillion in deals for AI data centers, processing chips on its GPUs, and cloud infrastructure. AI companies like OpenAI are energy guzzlers, and companies are scrambling to build more data centers to meet AI's massive power needs. Goldman Sachs estimates AI-driven data centers are set to consume 8% of total U.S. electricity by 2030. The $1 trillion in OpenAI computing power deals, first reported by the Financial Times, comes as the company's revenue falls far behind those commitments. Tech analysts say the massive spending into a technology some consider overhyped is reminiscent of the dot-com bubble of the early 2000s, when the NASDAQ crashed 77% and led to a recession. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
The price of gold has soared above $4,000 per troy ounce for the first time. Analysts say many investors are seeking a safe haven to park their money as the U.S. government shutdown continues. This is NPR News from Washington. Peace talks between Israel and Hamas continue in Egypt on the 2-year anniversary of Hamas's surprise attack that triggered Israel's war in Gaza. The talks focus on President Trump's proposal to end the fighting, which would require Hamas to disarm. Indian pilots are asking the country's aviation regulator to inspect all Boeing 787 Dreamliners operating in the country. That's after a weekend incident revived safety concerns. NPR's Dia Hadid reports from Mumbai.
The request came after a Dreamliner abruptly deployed an emergency power system midair during an Air India flight to Britain. The device would normally be activated when an aircraft's engines lose power or its hydraulic systems register critically low pressure. or its electrical systems fail. But the Federation of Indian Pilots says the emergency power system was engaged unexpectedly. Air India told AP that an initial inspection found that all electrical and hydraulic parameters were normal and that the aircraft landed safely. In June, a Dreamliner bound for London crashed in the Indian city of Ahmedabad shortly after takeoff, killing 260 people. The cause is still under investigation. Dia Hadid, NPR News, Mumbai.
NFL kickers are making more long-distance field goals more frequently, with many exceeding 60 yards. The shift has sparked questions about whether the balls are altered. A rule change this year allows teams to prepare balls before game day. There have already been four kicks of at least 60 yards this season, close to the single-season record. I'm Ryland Barton. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
6 minutes after 4 o'clock, you're listening to All Things Considered on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Widespread frost is expected tonight, clear, lows 26 to 30. And tomorrow, sunny, highs 58 to 64, winds from the south. Donating stocks and mutual funds is a quick, easy way to defend KAXE from funding cuts. You may receive tax benefits as well. Call Sarah for more details, 218-326-1234.
Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. The Hamas attack 2 years ago on October 7th, 2023 was the deadliest day in Israeli history. Israel's ensuing war in Gaza has been the deadliest and most destructive Palestinians have ever endured. Negotiations are bringing hope the war will finally end. This week, NPR is reporting on the consequences of the war. Today on Morning Edition, we heard about the extraordinary toll for families in Gaza. Now we bring this report from Israel about the costs of war Israelis have endured. Here is NPR's Daniel Estrin.
On a street named Gaza lives Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Outside his home stands a man with a megaphone.
Bibi and Sara.
Bibi and Sara, he calls out to the Prime Minister and his wife. It's Rome's dad, Ofir Braslavsky. Rome is his 21-year-old son being held hostage in Gaza. As Israel intensified the war this year, families of hostages intensified their war with Netanyahu. I'm not going to let you kill my son and bring him back in a body bag, he says. Mor Godard lost both her parents on October 7th, and much more. I lost my trust in the country. My trust in the army. Terrorists entered my house. Tried to open the safe room door. And when they didn't succeed, they set the house on fire. And nobody came. I know what the feeling of abandonment is. Hours when nobody comes. Hours when I hear my friends and parents being murdered, she says. Her father's body is still held by militants in Gaza as a bargaining chip in the war. She's mourning her parents and also the road Israel has taken in the last 2 years. They're acting out of revenge and not out of values, she says. This is one cost of the prolonged war. Not all Israelis believe in it anymore. Psychiatrist Dr. Oren Tene from Tel Aviv Medical Center.
When a nation goes to war and is not unified in belief that we're doing the right thing, then the propensity for the suffering is much higher.
He's tracked a rise in the use of anti-anxiety medications. The war with Iran this summer was especially traumatizing. Iranian missiles pounded Israeli cities. He's seen an influx of patients.
They don't sleep well. They can't concentrate. They feel worried all the time. They don't know if they have a future here.
He's also treated young soldiers coming back from Gaza with survivor's guilt, often overseeing their own friends killed by a high rate of friendly fire.
So the price of sending people to war is enormous. And I'm not talking about the price of the other side. We have to think of the other side.
The Palestinian side. Dr. Tene has treated many soldiers grappling with what mental health practitioners call moral injury or moral trauma.
Many people describe the fact that they have betrayed their values.
He says his patients have acknowledged shooting Palestinian civilians.
And if you shot a child, the child walks with you.
What soldiers see in Gaza, most Israelis do not see. And that's another cost of the war, Israelis' loss of empathy for Palestinian suffering. At a rally for hostages, demonstrator Karen Gill says she's sad to see her sympathies change so much in the last 2 years.
Before the war, before October 7th, my thinking was there are families there and there are people who want to live quiet and have their own lives. But today, I don't think that anyone in Gaza is innocent.
She's appalled by Israeli accounts of hostages held in families' homes. The military says some were held captive in the home of a Gaza doctor.
Is it reasonable that a doctor in Gaza was taking hostages to his home? I cannot believe it happened. So for me, I don't care about the Gaza people.
An Israeli researcher of Middle East politics, Asaf David, is trying to help restore empathy. He's built a following online, translating to Hebrew the Facebook posts of ordinary Palestinians, like this post from a father in Gaza.
Roughly it says, this is my picture with my child Mira before the war. I love her very much. I lost her. I didn't get the chance to say goodbye to her, and I don't know who buried her.
David says these social media posts help Israelis gain awareness.
I'm too terrified to think about the long-term costs of this lack of empathy, because it feeds on itself. The psychological costs, they affect your soul.
The cost globally to Israel is clear. Anti-war protests like this one last weekend in Rome are common across Europe. Israeli authorities have tracked a wave of attacks on Jews and Israelis throughout the war. Israel is fending off accusations of genocide and war crimes in international courts. The Israeli government has warned Israelis to lower their profile abroad. But that hasn't stopped them from traveling. We visit the Tel Aviv International Airport, Israeli's gateway to escape the intensity of life at war. We meet a 25-year-old soldier.
My name is Arshvi Avata. And I'm going to take my journey to Georgia.
He served in Gaza in an elite undercover unit, while the rest of his unit is doing group therapy with a psychologist to process. He skipped out.
I ran away from this. I don't want to do that. I want to fly. I want to see the world. And I feel that this works for me better than seats next to psychologist and, you know, speak. Yeah.
We leave the airport and pass stickers on the walls, many bearing the smiling faces of young Israeli soldiers killed in the war. One stands out with a quote from a mother's eulogy to her soldier son. It says, "Our story will have a good ending." Once the war does end, Israelis will begin to reckon with the costs they've paid over the last 2 years. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Flights across the U.S. are being delayed again today because of a shortage of air traffic controllers. Federal regulators say staffing shortages were to blame for ground delays last night at busy airports serving New York, Los Angeles, and Denver. And that is just one of the ways the ongoing government shutdown may affect commercial aviation. NPR Transportation Joel Rose has been watching all this. He's here now. Hey, Joel.
Hey, Mary Louise.
Start with those delays last night. What actually happened?
Well, the Federal Aviation Administration says a staffing shortage caused delays at three airports, Denver, Newark, New Jersey, and Burbank, California.
Okay.
Maybe the worst problems were at that Hollywood Burbank airport. There were zero air traffic controllers on duty for several hours.
Zero.
Zero. Controllers at another FAA facility in Southern California actually had to take over communicating with the pilots. That led to average delays of more than 2 hours at that airport. Overall, the FAA says a dozen facilities had staffing shortages yesterday, and at last check, eight facilities have shortages today, including towers at O'Hare International Airport in Chicago and in Nashville. We are already seeing ground delays at both of those airports, and there are staffing shortages at facilities that handle traffic around big hubs, also in Newark and Houston, so potentially could see an even bigger mess today.
Although you have been here telling us about staffing shortages in the not-so-recent past, is this all because of the shutdown?
There already was a nationwide shortage of air traffic controllers, to be sure, which has nothing to do with the government shutdown. Okay. Staffing is several thousand controllers short of where the FAA and the controllers union say it should be. Nearly 11,000 certified controllers do have to work during the shutdown, but they do not get paid until it ends. During the last shutdown back in 2018 and 2019, we saw controllers calling in sick in higher than normal numbers, especially once that shutdown dragged on past a month. And that caused some serious delays at major airports on the East Coast and may have even played a key role in bringing that shutdown to an end. There has been a small uptick in the number of controllers calling in sick this year, according to federal officials, but as we've seen, it doesn't take huge numbers to have a big impact.
Joel, I have to catch a flight this week. I'm sure I'm not alone in people listening to you and thinking, hold on, should I even be doing this? Is it safe to fly right now?
The FAA and the Department of Transportation say yes, emphatically, their top priority is keeping the system safe. But if they have to, they will limit the number of takeoffs and essentially reduce the number of planes in the air. And that leads to delay. Here is Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy at a press conference yesterday in Newark.
Is our airspace unsafe? No. Right? If we think there's issues in the airspace, we will shut it down. We will close it down. We will delay.
That is what we saw yesterday and are already seeing again today.
One more thing, Joel. We've been talking about big airports that serve big cities for the most part. What about the possible impact of the shutdown on rural airports? Because there's stuff happening there, too.
Yes. There's a federal program that subsidizes flights to rural airports. It's called the Essential Air Service Program. There are about 170 smaller communities around the country that likely would not have commercial air service without it, including more than 60 in Alaska alone. The Trump administration says that program will run out of money as soon as this weekend if the shutdown continues. But that said, it is not clear exactly how much of an immediate impact we would see. At least one major carrier, Alaska Airlines, says it will continue flights for now, even without that subsidy. And it is likely that the smaller regional airlines that operate most of these flights would do the same, at least for a while. I also want to note the White House proposed cutting more than $300 million from that program earlier this year, even though it has broad bipartisan support in Congress.
Thank you, Joel.
You're welcome.
And NPR's Joel Rose.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thanks for listening to All Things Considered on KAXE. It's 4:18. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a moment, our daily dose of phenology with John Latimer. Support comes from Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. We can expect frost overnight with clear skies, lows 26 to 30. Sunny tomorrow, highs 58 to 64.
On today's date, October 7th, 1996, we had our first frost of the fall. If you define frost as the first day with temperatures below 32 degrees, then in the 108 years of record keeping here in the Grand Rapids area, 18 years have had frosts occurring in August, all before 1986, with the exception of 2004. 76 years had the first frost occurring in September, and 8 of those years, the frost occurred in October, with all occurring after 1988, with the exception of 1921. Historically, the average first date for frost is September 15th. Our 30-year average is September 22nd. The earliest frost ever occurred on August 11, 1918, and the latest frost ever occurred on October 10, 1997. Historically, our growing season has been 113 days, but if you look at just the last 30 years, we've had a growing season of 127 days.
Here comes from this station and from BritBox, committed to helping viewers to see it differently with British TV. With new original series like Code of Silence, about a deaf woman recruited as a lip reader in a high-stakes police investigation, streaming at BritBox.com. And from Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers, and I'll let our next guest introduce herself.
I'm Macy Neely. I'm 27, and I'm originally from Orange County, California. I always tell everyone I'm from California so they know I'm cool.
Macy Neely is one of the stars of Hulu's hit reality series, The Secret Lives of Mormon Wives. The show gives you little glimpses of her life as a wife, mother, and businesswoman. But in her new memoir, Told You So, she throws the doors to her past wide open, pulling details from some of her darkest moments from the journal she kept, a gift from her dad.
I had just gotten home from college. I was pregnant and was kind of trying to figure out what to do with my life. And my dad came into my room carrying a black diary. And he was basically like, write everything down, you know, the bad, the good, the ugly, when you're mad at us, when you're sad. And maybe you can use this one day to help somebody else and write a book.
Now she's done just that. Told You So begins with a devastating paragraph about that time, quote, "The day my boyfriend dies, he texts me to say he's sorry. He'll never forgive himself for hurting me while I'm pregnant with his baby." I was curious, so I asked her, why start with such a painful moment?
I started there to kind of give people a summary of what's to happen. If anything, for me, it's almost like a trigger warning for people to know this is going to be, you know, it's going to be rough, but also it's going to be able to relate to so many different people who have gone through something similar.
You grew up in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and attended church with your family, abided by the social rules of your religion. But you also write that you've always been a person who's intrigued with things that were off limits, that you weren't told the reasoning behind many of the rules of your faith. I'm also a person who's questioned why things are the way they are and think about that in the context of my own religious upbringing. So I wonder, how do you think about that now? Have you sort of been able to square all of that?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I've always been a really curious person, and I do feel like I got most of that curiosity out during my college years. But yeah, I think I take what I want to take, and then I leave some of the other stuff that doesn't really feel like it applies to me in my life. And I think just going through everything did help with that, because I realized that, you know, alcohol and other things didn't mesh well with me when I was curious. I also didn't really know what I was doing because I wasn't educated a lot on it growing up. And so I feel like I was kind of an all-in kind of girl. And so I'm like, that kind of scares me. And I think I've experienced it enough. And now I'm like, I'm good. Just in all stems from, you know, those wild days.
You're also now a mom. So I wonder, how are you raising your children to think about the big stuff like sex and drugs and faith in the church?
Yeah. So I feel like I have this conversation with my husband a lot where I think you learn from your own experiences and how your parents raised you, which I think my parents were so great, but there's certain aspects where I'm like, okay, with my kids, I'm actually going to do this. And I feel like one of those things is having a better education on sex, obviously, as number one, because I got pregnant so young. So that's always going to be a priority. And then also drinking and stuff, you know? So I feel like I'm trying to keep an open conversation when my kids get to that age where it's like, hey, you'd prefer you don't do these things for X, Y, and Z reasons, but you will make mistakes. And if you do make these mistakes, please let us know, come to us, we'll help you. And my dad kind of did that for me growing up, but I still just didn't feel comfortable enough, you know, to come to my parents. And I wasn't educated really on sex at all. Just kind of don't do it. So I definitely think my kids I'll probably educate them a little bit more on safety and stuff.
Several times throughout your book, you write about having sat down, meeting with a bishop, the process of repenting, which is something that is normal in your faith. And in some of these encounters, when you describe them, you leave and you feel better. But in others, you feel cut down. There's
One meeting that you talk about where you're trying to speak out about the assault that you experienced, and you say that you were made to feel like the perpetrator rather than someone who was harmed. And I just have to say, reading that, it sounded really challenging.
Oh, yeah, it was very difficult. I remember just like after that meeting with my bishop, I went to my dad's car and I just started sobbing because I was like, I just felt, I don't know, like so dismissed in that moment. And then like deep down, I feel like it made me hold all this, you know, stuff inside. And then all of a sudden I was like, it's my fault for all these things that happened. That's like how I left feeling. And that stuck with me for years until I finally went to therapy for the first time. And I know so many people in the church have experiences like I do, like where they have a bishop who, you know, doesn't believe them, or a bishop who, you know, makes them feel horrible inside. And that's what happened to me. And there also are great bishops in the church. And it's just like, you don't really know what you're going to get, I guess.
Hmm. I mean, it seems like at times your faith is a real anchor for you. And then at other times it seems to feel restrictive and like a source of pressure to be and act and live a certain way. Macy, how has your relationship with God changed over time?
I would say my relationship has grown in the sense of like, I don't have to be perfect to be worthy and be loved in God's eyes. And I think sometimes the culture of the church can cause you to have these thoughts that you aren't worthy, even though it's the culture, it's not the actual gospel of the church. And so I think it's something that I've had to separate from myself, being like, okay, just because the culture is like this and the standards are like this, and doesn't mean that since I broke those that I'm a bad person and that I'm less worthy in God's eyes. And so I think like, as I've gotten older, and honestly, I always say this, my brain has developed knowing that I, you know, can have a great relationship with God and Jesus. I don't have to be this like perfect, like example of a Mormon.
In the book, you reference the statement from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which made headlines. Now, it doesn't explicitly mention the show, but I just want to read part of it. It says, mm-hmm. A number of recent productions depict lifestyles and practices blatantly inconsistent with the teachings of the church. And when you wrote about this in the book, you say that you're over living your life focused on what church members think. You are active in your church.
Yeah.
You tithe. You follow the guidelines of your faith. Macy Neely, what was the reaction like after the show's debut?
Yeah, it was rough to say the least. And, you know, I had to chalk it up to a couple things, is because when the show trailer came out, it basically looked like, you know, we were all drinking, partying, swinging, you know, and calling ourselves Mormon. And so now from an outsider perspective, I do understand why people were mad. I was having a little bit of a hard time because you were just getting shamed so much that I was almost like, wait, am I doing something wrong? Like, I started getting like really anxious because I'm like, I don't even break any of the guidelines for the most part. I think once the show actually came out and people saw more than the trailer, they realized, oh, like, that's like actually a very, very small part of it. But there's definitely still people who haven't watched it and are judging it based off the trailer, and they refuse to watch it, you know, so.
I know that the show is obviously more than the trailer, but in that trailer for the first season of the show, you say, we're trying to change the stigma of the gender roles in the Mormon church, and that's a really big goal. Do you think that the show has begun to chip away at some of the perceptions?
I think it has, and I think the reason why I feel like it's working is because of the amount of DMs that I've gotten from women being like, wow, thank you so much for like sharing this and, you know, this show, honestly, because I think a lot of people will leave the church, or maybe they'll go, but they just don't feel worthy to be there because of the stereotypes that kind of come with it and the expectations. And so I feel like people watch our show and being like, wow, I can be Mormon and I can swear. I can be Mormon and wear tank tops. I can be Mormon and drink a coffee, you know? And so I think that's what the show has helped with. Like, and I've had many people who have wanted to be Mormon because of the show, which is so funny to me. So I feel like if anything, it's had a positive impact, and it shows people that they don't have to be perfect to be part of a religion and be close to God and Jesus, is what I would say.
We have been speaking with Macy Neely. She's one of the stars of Hulu's The Secret Lives of Mormon Wives, and her memoir, Told You So, is out now. Macy, thank you.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's 4:29. You're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Up next, National Native News. 1 hour from now, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. Support comes from the Edge Center for the Arts in Big Fork, presenting Sketches of Minnesota, a civic community comedy tour. Saturday, October 11th, doors at 5, dinner at 6. It's open to all with registration required. More info at edgecenterarts.org. Frost tonight with mostly clear skies, lows 26 to 30. Sunny tomorrow, highs 58 to 64, winds from the south 5 to 15. Our lows tomorrow night in the low to mid 40s, and Thursday mostly sunny, highs in the mid to upper 60s. The KAXE news team has been covering cuts to libraries in our region, and this week we are gathering stories about what libraries mean to you. Text us 218-326-1234.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The U.S. Supreme Court will not reconsider the nonprofit Apache Strongholds effort to preserve sacred lands from a massive copper mining project east of Phoenix, Arizona. The justices Monday declined to revisit an earlier decision to throw out the case for a second and final time. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio has more.
Court records show conservative Neil Gorsuch stands alone in supporting the nonprofit's plea. Justice Clarence Thomas previously joined him in co-authoring a May dissent, recusing himself once more with Samuel Alito, who has disclosed stock holdings in BHP, the Australian-based minority partner behind Resolution Copper. In a statement, Resolution Copper told KJZZ it's pleased the court upheld a split Ninth Circuit ruling that Oak Flat is not subject to religious freedom protections. While on social media, Apache Stronghold says it's deeply disappointing that Mother Earth's voice goes unheard yet again. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
Last week, the Confederated Tribes of Siletz Indians held a grand opening for its latest off-reservation housing development in Salem, Oregon. The site is a mixed-income living facility with 39 units. Brian Bull of Buffalo's Fire reports.
An honor song and ribbon cutting officially opened the Klosh Ilahi Haas Complex. About 60 people attended the ceremony, including tribal member Vera Vasquez. The working mother of three explored the 2- and 4-bedroom units, excited for the next day when she'd move in with her family from their much smaller home.
This is changing my life. We've been literally bursting at the seams in our 2-bedroom, so it's just going to be really nice to have space. And what I'm really looking forward to, though, is having the community and the garden and the tribal activities. Our kids can play and grow up together, and we can really connect as people.
Tribal officials say Native people in Oregon experience homelessness 4 times more than other demographics. And Salem has the 2nd highest population of Siletz citizens, next to the tribal headquarters and reservation area. Many left for cities and coastal industries after Congress terminated the tribe's federal status in 1954. Even after being reinstated in 1977, many Siletz people stayed in those areas. Tribal Chair Dee Pigsley says they're also looking at the city of Eugene.
They've all been really tough areas to provide housing because we don't own land there. We have to buy the land, and it's land that comes at a premium. And then we have to find money to build the homes.
The Klosh Ilahi Haas complex cost $17 million. Half of that was covered by an Indian Housing Block grant, while the tribe covered the rest. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull in Salem, Oregon.
The Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes in Oklahoma, in partnership with the U.S. Army, have begun the process of returning 16 children home from the Carlisle Indian Industrial School in Pennsylvania. In a press release Monday, the tribe said it's a solemn and historic undertaking more than 2 years in the making. The disinterment began in September at the Carlisle Cemetery. The tribe say the month-long project represents a moment of healing and remembrance, carried out with descendant ceremonial leaders, tribal officials, forensic experts, and Army representatives. The children will be reinterred on tribal land in Concho, Oklahoma. 11 Cheyenne and 5 Arapaho children who passed away while attending the school are returning home. 13 were under the age of 18. The federal school opened in 1879. Native children were forced to assimilate and were trained in various trades. According to the tribes, the repatriation marks an important step toward justice and healing for the families and tribal nations impacted by the boarding school era. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law.
Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for over 40 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. And from Subaru. Subaru has donated more than $70 million to support the adoption, rescue, transport, and health of over 700,000 animals. Learn more at subaru.com/pets. This is NPR.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. There is finally some clarity on who can get the updated COVID-19 shot. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has announced new guidelines. And NPR health correspondent Rob Stein is here to help us understand what we all need to know. Hi.
Hey, Juana.
Rob, so tell us, what did the CDC have to say?
Sure. The CDC finally acted yesterday and says more people are eligible for one of the boosters than the Food and Drug Administration initially allowed when the FDA approved the reformulated shots in August. So anyone aged 6 months and older should now be eligible again. But the CDC did create one new hoop that people have to jump through to get a shot. Everyone now has to have a conversation first with a healthcare professional about the risks and benefits.
Okay, so adding another step there, do you have a sense of how much of a barrier that might be?
You know, for a lot of people, it may not be a big deal. The CDC defines healthcare professional pretty broadly to include not only doctors, but also nurse practitioners and pharmacists. So an extra stop at a doctor's office may not be necessary. And the CDC's action makes clear that any pharmacist anywhere would be able to give the shots. CVS, the nation's biggest pharmacy chain, says people won't have to fill out any forms or even have to have a conversation with a pharmacist unless they have questions. But some pharmacists and doctors may still require a conversation, or they may be hesitant to give the shots to anyone who isn't at high risk because of all the mixed messages and changing rules. And some doctors just may not stock the shots this year. So don't be surprised if you still encounter problems. I talked about this with Dr. Michelle Fiscus. She's the chief medical officer for the Association of Immunization Managers.
It's not as easy as if we just had a blanket universal recommendation that anybody who wants a vaccine can get a vaccine, but there aren't huge restrictions like the need to meet eligibility criteria to get a vaccine either. So it's not as restrictive as it could have been, but it still puts barriers in the way.
Rob, a question probably on a lot of people's minds is, will insurance still pay for the shots?
The answer is yes. The CDC's action guarantees that, and also guarantees that Medicaid and Medicare will pay for them as well. And the Federal Vaccines for Children program, which provides vaccines for free to 40% of all children, can now finally start shipping out the shots. The program started taking orders yesterday, so shots should start arriving within about a week.
Last thing, Rob, a question I've been hearing a lot among my social circles is, how good is the protection from these updated vaccines, and when should people get them?
Yeah, the updated shots look like they're a pretty good match for the strains that are currently circulating, so they should provide pretty good protection. Timing is a personal decision. COVID's still out there, but the winter surge hasn't started yet, so you could wait a bit to make sure your immunity boost is strongest over the holidays and during the surge. But anyone who's at risk shouldn't wait if it's been at least 2 or 3 months since their last COVID illness or booster. And if you have any plans to travel or go to a big indoor gathering anytime soon, you might think about getting a shot right away, because it takes a couple of weeks for the immunity to kick in. And parents who want to vaccinate their young kids should probably start as soon as they can, since children need 2 shots spaced 4 weeks apart the first time they get immunized.
NPR health correspondent Rob Stein, thanks as always.
You bet.
Today, the Supreme Court seemed ready to side with a Christian therapist who objects to a Colorado law that she maintains violates her free speech rights. If the court does rule in her favor, the decision could invalidate laws in some two dozen states, laws that bar therapists from practicing a version of talk therapy that seeks to change a teenager's sexual orientation or gender identity. NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg reports.
Today's case involved a new wrinkle on an old therapy, specifically something called conversion therapy. It's generally defined as a treatment used to change a person's attraction for same-sex individuals and to similarly cure gender dysphoria. In whatever form, the therapy has been forcefully repudiated by every major medical organization in the country on grounds that the therapy doesn't work and often leads to depression and suicidal thoughts in minors. But today at the Supreme Court, lawyers for Colorado therapist Kaylee Childs told the justices that the way their client practices involves no physical restraints or coercion of any kind. Rather, said lawyer James Campbell, it's all talk therapy, and the state's ban on what Childs does prevents these voluntary conversations with minors.
Ms. Childs is being silenced. The kids and the families who want help, this kind of help that she'll offer, are being left without any support.
Representing Colorado, State Solicitor General Shannon Stevenson replied by noting the high rates of suicide among minors who face problems about their sexuality and gender. Responding to questions from the justices, she said that under the state's conversion therapy law, therapists may not promise a cure that will transform a gay teenager into a straight teenager.
It would be banned. If it was, can you help me cope with my feelings as to how I am and how I want to live my life? That's permitted.
Conservative Justice Samuel Alito had this reaction.
Looks like blatant viewpoint discrimination.
By viewpoint discrimination, he meant that in his view, the state was supporting one way of dealing with sexuality in minors, but unconstitutionally silencing a different view. Liberal Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson had a somewhat different take, noting that medical doctors would clearly be liable if they used a medication that the state deemed substandard care.
It's just a little puzzling to me that she would stand in a different position than a medical professional who has exactly the same goals and would just be prescribing medication rather than her talking with the client.
But most of the other justices, including Liberal Justice Elena Kagan, didn't seem to see things that way. Here's Kagan.
Just assume that we're in normal free speech land rather than in this kind of doctor land. And if a doctor says, I know you identify as gay and I'm going to help you accept that. And another doctor says, I know you identify as gay and I'm going to help you to change that. And one of those is permissible and the other is not. That seems like viewpoint discrimination in the way we would normally understand viewpoint discrimination.
Childs, for her part, has not used her preferred therapy on anyone yet because she says she fears losing her license as a therapist or being fined if she did. Her lawyers say that the Colorado law thus unconstitutionally chills her right to free speech. The state's contrary view is that it must ensure that medical professionals do not engage in debunked psychological theories that are condemned by organizations as diverse as the American Medical Association and the American Psychological Association. But today, a clear majority of the justices across ideological lines seemed inclined to rule against the Colorado law, and in doing so, they could be upending similar state laws in half the country. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. It's 4:44. Coming up next, North Star Stories, produced by Ampers. Stories from throughout Minnesota. Support comes from Bemidji Brewing, announcing the return of their espresso porter filled with roasted coffee flavor. Now on tap and in cans throughout the region, Bemidji Beer, nice catch. We also thank the McKnight Foundation. Brainerd Lions Club and Brainerd Public Schools invite you to choose kindness this evening from 5:30 to 7:30 at Forest View Middle School. There will be music, a meal, kindness activities, and more. Kootaska Community Action in Grand Rapids is collecting gently used kids' Halloween costumes now until October 15th. Costumes may be dropped at the former Murphy Elementary building from 9 to 4 on weekdays. Let us know what's happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxe.org. North Star Stories up next. Thanks for listening to KAXE.
You are listening to North Star Stories, voices from where we live, a daily newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota.
Today, Minnesota health officials make recommendations about COVID-19 vaccinations. Then, a Minnesotan taken from us at an early age who left a lasting legacy. And the Pardons Board denies clemency for a Twin Cities professor. I'm Chantel Sings. The Minnesota Department of Health, or MDH, is endorsing new COVID-19 vaccine recommendations from top medical groups. Health officials say the vaccines prevent severe illness and death, and they want to ensure broad access. The guidance recommends vaccination for everyone over 6 months old, with a strong emphasis on children under 2, pregnant women, high-risk individuals, and older adults. More information is available at the MDH website. In today's main story, Catherine DeSalle remembers the extraordinary life and legacy of Simone Senegals, a dedicated Indigenous activist who passed away in Bemidji at the age of 54.
The world has lost a compassionate protector, advocate, and justice fighter, Simone Senegals, who recently passed away in September.
Bonjour, Chinotinikwe Indigenikas. My name is Simone Senegals. My family is from the Red Lake Nation here in northern Minnesota.
That's Simone speaking in Regaining Food Sovereignty, a documentary she wrote and directed with Lakeland PBS, a public TV station serving northern Minnesota, and the Indigenous Environmental Network. The documentary was about the food systems in northern Minnesota Native communities.
This is a story about food. It's about our relationship with food as Indigenous peoples and as all human beings.
Simone worked with the Indigenous Environmental Network for more than 25 years, advocating for environmental justice and Indigenous rights.
Indigenous people suffer disproportionately from health problems. It's the result of a corporate-controlled global food system that values profit over human and ecological health.
Simone was a lifelong activist whose journey began as a teenager at the Northland Poster Collective, a South Minneapolis organization known for printing activist-inspired art. Simone went on to be a founding member of MMIW 218, an organization based in Bemidji, Minnesota, which is dedicated to raising awareness of missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit relatives.
The National Crime Information Database reports that there are 5,712 known incidents of missing and murdered Indigenous women as of 2016. There's so many that we don't know about.
In 2017, Simone gave an interview on Amper station KAXE Radio in Grand Rapids to raise awareness of missing and murdered Indigenous women.
There's a few things that go on that contribute to the lack of information and action around missing and murdered Indigenous women. Racism and discrimination, the devaluing of Indigenous women. If you want to disempower a people, you attack the women.
With the organization Grassroots Global Justice, Simone co-founded the Feminist Organizing Schools, designed to create a feminist economy that provides political education and leadership development.
We have to be brave, and we have to be willing to look hard at ourselves and see ourselves as part of a system that has been against us for many, many years. Also have strength to stand up against injustice.
Simone Senegals was an artist, beekeeper, mother, wife, friend, and member of the Eagle Clan, who left an everlasting impact on her community. Senegal's wake took place on September 25th, and traditional services were held September 26th in Red Lake. For North Star Stories, I'm Catherine Dessel.
You are listening to North Star Stories. The Minnesota Board of Pardons has denied a full pardon to Jason Soule, a formerly incarcerated abolitionist and Hamline University professor in St. Paul. Soule served time for firearm and drug convictions in the 1990s and early 2000s. In a newsletter, he said that he was not included in hearings but remains hopeful for future consideration. The Board of Pardons, made up of the governor, attorney general, and chief justice, requires at least two votes to grant clemency.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. In Wisconsin, Planned Parenthood has stopped providing abortions at its clinics. That's because of a provision in the recently passed budget law under President Trump. As NPR's Katie O'Riddle reports, Wisconsin is not the only place where abortion access is quickly shifting.
To be clear, it's already illegal to use federal funding to pay for abortions. But Planned Parenthood also offers other kinds of health care, like cancer screenings and birth control. The new law essentially penalizes organizations like Planned Parenthood that provide abortions by withholding Medicaid payments from them for any health care services.
It's a terrible, terrible decision to be forced into because of politics.
Tanya Atkinson is the CEO of Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin. Atkinson says they had to weigh their options, stop providing abortions or stop being paid through Medicaid for other kinds of care. She says in some parts of the state, they are the only healthcare option for low-income patients.
Tens of thousands of Wisconsin women and people across the entire state who have Medicaid as their form of insurance wouldn't be able to access care at Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin.
The law is being challenged in court. For now, the organization says it is referring people to other places for abortions, including in nearby Illinois. Danica Severino-Wynn is with Planned Parenthood Federation of America. She says other clinics across the country could stop providing abortions for the same reason.
That is possible, but we are committed to continuing to find a pathway forward to abortion care in every state where it's legal.
Severino-Wynn accuses the Trump administration of trying to cripple Planned Parenthood. Asked for a comment on this story, an official from the Department of Health and Human Services, Andrew Nixon, said, quote, HHS is enforcing the law, end quote. Severino-Wynn says the administration is having an impact.
There have been more than 40 Planned Parenthood health centers that have closed since the start of 2025.
Recent data from the Guttmacher Institute, which supports abortion rights, shows that fewer people are traveling out of state for abortions in 2025. In part, they say, that's because it's increasingly difficult to find a clinic, even in states where abortion is legal. However, they don't think this means people are having fewer of them. Isabel DoCampo is one of the researchers on this data.
It may be that for many patients, getting care via telehealth in their state of residence is a better option than traveling out of state for abortion care.
Telehealth abortion is when people get a prescription from a medical professional, either in their state or in another state, and then get abortion medication through the mail. DoCampo says patients are increasingly choosing this option instead of traveling to clinics for in-person appointments.
Travel out of state for healthcare is always an extremely challenging endeavor. It's financially complex, it's emotionally taxing, it's logistically complex as well.
But advocates warn that even though telehealth is being used more than ever, it is a precarious system. Mary Ziegler is a law professor at University of California, Davis, who studies reproductive rights.
So there is really no guarantee that telehealth is going to stick around.
Ziegler points out that telehealth and the abortion medications that are mailed as a result are under attack from a number of different directions. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. just announced the government will be reviewing the, quote, safety and efficacy of the abortion medication mifepristone. Research shows the medication is safe and effective. Ziegler points out that telehealth channels to abortion are vulnerable to these kinds of legal challenges because of the way they've evolved.
There's been this entire model of care that's grown up in the shadow of this great legal and political uncertainty.
The way people access abortion, she says, has changed dramatically in recent years. It could change dramatically again in the near future.
What happens if telehealth is no longer an option? Where do those patients go?
Especially, she says, if clinics are no longer offering abortion, even in states where it's legal. Katie Riddle, NPR News.
Some of the first moving images of Native Americans were recently rediscovered in Idaho. They're in a rare silent film shown to the public for the first time in decades. Northwest Public Broadcasting's Lauren Patterson was there.
In a crowded theater in Moscow, Idaho, Nakia Williams and Cloud, a historian with the Nez Perce tribe, says the newly rediscovered film being shown here is powerful. There are very few motion pictures of Nez Perce people from the early 20th century.
The lodges, the horses, and even a lot of the ceremonies that are represented are authentic Nez Perce ceremonies that our people carried forth from the time of the buffalo days to the time of the reservation period.
Told in the Hills is a Western made in the silent film era. It's a fictional story of Jack Stewart, a man from a wealthy family who moves west and is accused of killing an Indian chief. Its goal wasn't to document Native American dances and ceremonies, but it did. In fact, a federal law at the time forbade the kinds of traditional indigenous religious practices captured in the film. Depicting the actual ceremonies, even if they were in a fictional film, Williamson Cloud says, ended up preserving those traditions.
That just shows the resiliency of our people and the ability to kind of try to find those openings and those times where they could express who they really were.
About 120 people came to what archivists called Told in the Hills restoration premiere. After the film made its initial run in 1919, it disappeared. A copy ended up in Russia, which was often the last stop for films touring Europe, says Alex Maragalia, an archivist with Boise State University and a bit of a film buff.
The Soviets had a penchant for creating an archive, and a lot of American silent films are still there.
In the 1980s, an English professor at Boise State who was researching early Idaho films got a tip that Told in the Hills might be in the Soviet Union. He wrote to the Russians, who said they had the film, and sent it to the university in 1987. It's only being shown publicly now because Colin Mannix, who runs the Kenworthy Performing Arts Center here in Moscow, got a tip last spring that the film might be in the university archives. He found it, and with state and private funding, got the film digitized to 4K so it could be shown in theaters.
Part of what we're doing here with the Silent Film Festival is providing a stage, or a screen rather, for these films to be reintegrated to our collective cultural memory.
The restored version of the film was shown at the Kenworthy, its first showing since 1919. 120 people came to the Friday night show. Mother and daughter, Jennifer and Lisa Wilcox.
Yeah, it was really great. Neat little piece of history.
Yeah.
Bob Wood says he grew up in Kamiai, near the canyon where some of the scenes took place.
Warriors Canyon, I know it right off the bat. What did
you think of the movie?
I thought it was great. I just loved it. I knew this might be the only chance I'd ever have to see this, so I had to come.
Nakia Williamson Cloud, the tribal historian, says having the movie restored and preserved is a way for the tribe to revisit their ancestors.
Some of those songs that were sung at that time, our community still holds today.
He hopes that some traditional music from the tribe could be infused into future showings. But only two of the original six reels of Told in the Hills were recovered. The action scenes and many of the ceremonies featuring the tribe are still missing.
I think the big kind of hope would be that the rest of the film might come into discovery, and perhaps that could be edited back in.
Archivists say chances are slim, but Williamson Cloud is hopeful the other reels are out there somewhere. For NPR News, I'm Lauren Patterson in Moscow, Idaho.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from 20th Century Studios with Springsteen, Deliver Me From Nowhere, a pivotal chapter in the life of an icon, starring Jeremy Allen White and Jeremy Strong in theaters October 24th. Tickets available now. From Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options, at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From Easy Cater, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from a nationwide network of restaurants, create lunch programs for their employees, and manage food spend at easycater.com. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It is a minute before 5 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXC Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXC Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. We invite you to join us at KAXC.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Stay tuned for another hour of All Things Considered, including the Up North Report, local news from our region at 5:30. 6 o'clock, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective with the CBC. And at 7 tonight, Eric Otto, your volunteer host for On the River, bringing you a great mix of music. Our weather for tonight, we can expect frost, mostly clear, lows 26 to 30. Sunny tomorrow, highs 58 to 64, south winds 5 to 15. Not as cool.